Hi folks, just a heads up that this episode contains some frank discussion of sexual violence and the depiction of non-consensual sex in romance fiction. Hello everyone and welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic. I'm Austin Chant.
I'm Amanda Jean.
And this is our show. Today we are delighted to have Heidi Below joining us. Heidi is a wonderful author of many, many books. And as I've just been informed by Amanda, I apparently talk about her in every episode. So I'm excited.
Also,
I just hit the red in my audio.
Also, you should note that you did not say the title of this episode. Are you ashamed?
Do you want to? I am not. Would you like to do the honors?
Yes. So after much deliberation, we've decided that today's episode is somewhat aptly titled Heidi Below the Covers.
So Heidi, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Oh, my face is so red right now.
You can tell we take shit super seriously on this podcast, which is funny because we do. But I feel like we owed it to our listeners after months of being like, oh yeah, Dead Ringer. Oh yeah, fucking Flesh Cartel. Oh yeah, Wallflower. We mentioned Straight Shooter like 3 times. I feel like it's time you have earned your place as our guest. More than perhaps anyone.
You've built up to me. This has been a long time coming.
It's Heidi time.
It's Heidi time.
So, Heidi.
Yes. Hello.
So, Heidi, you write all sorts of books that I've talked about on this show. So, how can I start this in a way that isn't fanboying? Let's see. Heidi, you write all sorts of books, and you write in a lot of different genres. I know that I have personally brought up on this show the Rear Entrance video series, which is contemporary. You have also written fucked up sci-fi like Bliss and The King of Dublin. You have also written even a more adorable contemporary like Burnt Toast B&B and Flesh Cartel. And so you go all over the place. You've written contemporary sci-fi. And you've written heavy kink, you've written stuff that goes to some pretty dark places, you've also written some really sweet contemporary, and we wanted to talk about phases you have gone through in writing, or things that have been interesting for you to explore, and where you are going now.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to say I've also written urban fantasy, but nobody read that, I feel like. That's not true. Sometimes people will come up to me and be like, you wrote urban fantasy, and I'm just like, I didn't even know MM readers even read that, but apparently they do.
Wait, what's your urban fantasy?
I wrote The Druid Stone. That was my first novel that I completed and submitted to Carina Press way back in 2011 when I was still pregnant with my first daughter, so it's been a long time.
Oh my gosh.
That's like some deep tracks, Heidi Below.
Well, now I feel like a bad fanboy already.
You clearly are. You've failed the most important test,
no.
Which is the knowing my entire backlist test.
It is funny. I realized that Heidi, when the first book I saw by you was Wallflower, and I was all excited about Wallflower, and the first book I bought by you was The Flesh Cartel.
Oh my
and
God.
Those are
what
two very, very, very different books.
I guess I would go back in high school, my English teacher was a humongous fan of Walt Whitman. And he used to say all the time, I am large, I contain multitudes. And I think that's like sort of my philosophy towards my writing. I know that, you know, beginning authors hear a lot about branding and, you know, sticking to one thing or using different pen names for things. And I started out writing urban fantasy with a little bit of darkness. And then I, at the same time, like I was literally writing Apple Polisher, which is a romantic comedy, and The Flesh Cartel simultaneously. Like I want you to understand very clearly that I would literally spend one day writing Flesh Cartel, and then the next day switch to Apple Polisher and completely change my entire mindset. And I was actually writing those two books in sync the whole time. So I just kind of, I embraced the fact that I have these completely disparate sensibilities and interests and sort of just went with it. I know that I really considered doing a couple different pen names or, you know, not writing the darker stuff in the first place or like all kinds of different stuff. And I just ultimately wound up lumping it all together in this one weird human being that people now have to kind of figure out what I'm up to next. So I, if there's any aspiring authors listening, I don't know that I would advise it, but you know, if, I don't want to say that it's been a completely unsuccessful approach either, but it's definitely not for the faint of heart, just, you know, pinballing around between genres like a madman. But that's how I live my life.
I feel like you get to tap into completely different audiences, and seeing what the crossover there is fascinating. Like, I can't read some of your stuff, and yet other stuff, I'm like, you will tear it out of my cold, dead hands. Like, you manage to engage on multiple levels by using the same pen name, which I think is awesome. Like, yeah, it probably has its, like, marketing hang-ups and whatever, but I'm into it. I think it works.
Yeah, you know, there's a bit of an issue that people will sometimes come to me, and they'll be like, so this book you have coming out, is it a book that I will like, considering I like XYZ, or is it one of the books that I will not like, considering I like, you know, ABC? So that's kind of been a little difficult. Like, I hope the marketing and the covers kind of like lean you towards like, this one's going to be a romantic comedy, this one's going to be the dark stuff. Sometimes there are books that kind of lean in the middle. I feel like Dead Ringer kind of sits squarely in the middle of my two sides, and that it has some really funny moments, but it has some really dark moments too. And, you know, I found some of my lighter readers think it's a little too angsty, and some of my darker readers, I always talk about this, it's my favorite thing. I got a review, and I'm not going to go into like super detail, but the review was basically like, I expect more darkness from Heidi Bellow, and this is really, this book was very disappointing to me. And so I get the shared pen name maybe is a little bit frustrating for readers. I recently redid my website, and that was actually one of the main things I decided to do, was now when you go to my website, you can choose between dark fiction or erotic romance. So that really delineates it. It's even got like a completely different color scheme, but now you can say, if you're a dark fiction reader, you can say, here's all that stuff. Or if you're looking just for the light stuff, here's the lighter stuff. And then, you know, you don't have to worry about getting mixed up. I've very carefully hand selected them for you.
I like that they have different color schemes. It's really cute.
I feel like in some ways that lends something cool to your writing, because you'll have, you know, like a really sweet contemporary romance. I was just rereading Burnt Toast B&B, which all in all is like quite lighthearted and, yeah, and quite lovely. But at the same time, then if there is something like seriously emotional or screwed up that comes up, I can tell you don't hesitate to like jump in. You don't soften the blow, as it were. So like when Derek's like toxic masculinity comes to play in that book, you go in.
Yeah, it is a little weird, because, you know, all my, like, I consider that I have my dark fiction, I have my romantic comedies, but there is quite a bit of crossover, and quite a bit, like, I'm still the same human being, despite containing multitudes, so a little bit kind of creeps in either way. And, you know, I think I also, like, on the other side, I think I bring a bit of humor into my darker stuff as well. Like, not to say that I make light of the subject matter necessarily, although I'm sure some people feel that way. But I know that based on my own traumatic past, I really have, like, humor is a big coping method for me. And so that kind of really exists inside of my fiction as well. So it kind of all smears together. That's going to be my theme for today.
Yeah, those moments of crossover, I think, in some ways they lend a lot to, like, if you have something that is primarily really grim, those moments of like lightness and humor, I think they both provide kind of a break for the reader, but they also emphasize what you're writing. And the same thing is true for me in the contemporary romances that are lighter. When you have those moments where it gets real, it's really satisfying in a way, and it pairs well with the overall.
I think the only thing I really have to watch out for is when you're writing a romantic comedy and you introduce those darker elements. I know there's like a really transphobic scene, or transmisogynistic scene, I should really specify, in Wallflower. And writing that, you don't want that to come across as funny, because it's not funny and it's not meant to, like, it exists inside of a book that is at times funny, but it really, it's a dark moment, and you have to kind of like make sure that that levity is there, or not levity, but you know, that depth and etc.
Yeah. You want that to be the moment where the readers like feel a drop.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they're like, oh, this is also fun.
Yeah, no, definitely not. If I ever do that, I please hope that, you know, first of all, my beta readers slap me over the head. And if it gets past beta readers, then I hope an editor slaps me over the head. And then, you know, if it gets past editors, then obviously I should just be torn apart by all reviewers ever, because that's just unacceptable. So I give you full permission to review me terribly if I'm a shithead in any of my books.
I appreciate that. Not that, I mean, I feel like at that point, like,
I've been waiting to review you badly.
Amanda was waiting for permission. Waiting to strike.
I'm usually lying in wait. I'm a very bitchy reviewer sometimes. No, I think that, you know, at that point, if you get a book with some elements that are, I hate to use the buzzword, but like problematic or really terribly executed, or even just like a mistake, like you went for one tone and the other tone happened instead, like it would be odd if beta readers and editors and like whoever, like the head editor in charge of the slush pile or whoever, didn't notice it. Like, I'm sure it happens, shit is insidious, but I feel like by that point, especially with the presses that we've got in the queer romance community, by and large, people are, you know, they've got their eyes peeled for the insidious shit that creeps in.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like as an author, if I have to, that's one of the things I need to trust my press is looking for. I really need to know that they're gonna be there to kind of like temper me at times, or be there to warn me when I've strayed or anything like that. And I feel like I need to trust them to perform that function as much as I need to trust them to make sure that I don't have the word the three times in a row, or to make sure that, you know, I'm not saying that characters have like ejaculated a line of dialogue. So, you know, I think a press, you should also be entrusting your press to also be able to read with that eye. And I've definitely have had comments from my press and from beta readers that have like warned me away from some stuff. So, you know, the finished material, I'm sure a lot of people consider it problematic just for its existence, but it was worse at some points, which is actually a terrible thing to say.
You're like, look, I'm garbage, you but my press
so much worse.
My press saved me. That's actually a good point, because I'm kind of wondering, is there something that, you know, we'll talk about this later, but you haven't been writing as much grimdark, but is there something that you just wouldn't really ever want to approach? Is there a subject that to you is off limits? Is there a point at which you feel like, you know, stories kind of can't come back from?
Well, you know what? I have my own personal limits. We actually discussed this, Rachel and I, when we started pitching to each other the Flesh Cartel. We had a line, like, believe it or not, we did have a line that we didn't cross, and there were things that I didn't want. I didn't want any sympathetic rapist characters where you fall in love with your rapist. That was one thing I was not willing to write. I was not willing to write anything to do with children, like just completely off the table. No, thank you. And I honestly, personally, was not willing to write any female victims. So there are some female characters in the Flesh Cartel that appear, but I kind of dance around their victimization. They exist, but it's not quite
it's not on the
so
page.
In depth. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm sure some people would really feel that's kind of hypocritical of me that I'm able to write about men this way, but not about women that way. But that's my personal thing. You know, I have a history of sexual violence, and I just don't want to trigger myself while I'm writing, so I don't.
Yeah, I think if you're setting yourself up to write something where even you, the author, are having like problems grappling with it, it's kind of a doomed project.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think another thing too is I'd really hesitate. Like, I wrote this story, you know, about two men, and I don't know if I'd even at this time, I don't know if I were to at this point in time, if I were to say, oh, you know, I have this story idea, I don't know if I'd write the Flesh Cartel again. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying if I went back and changed it, but more at this point in my life, that's not a story I'd even write in the first place, I don't think. But where was my train of thought going? I guess the point I was trying to make is that I wrote this story about, you know, two cisgender men who I feel, you know, either are on equal footing with me as, like, you know, Matt is a queer man and I'm a queer woman, or you've got Doug who is a straight man. And so I feel like writing about victimization of someone who is privileged over me or, you know, on the same level as me is a very different thing from writing someone who is less privileged than me. So I feel like if I were to write that same story, but it was like, you know, of a story of a bunch of like horrible, like, I don't know, a transgender slave ring, that would be a really fucked up thing for me to write as a cisgender writer. So I definitely have that limit as well, like just going in, but, you know.
Yeah, don't punch down.
Yeah, exactly. And now I feel like maybe I'm more at the point where it's like, maybe I shouldn't punch at all, but but definitely don't punch down.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, having come to the sort of place that you're in now, like you could have only come to that having written the Flesh Cartel series. Like it's a part of your evolution as a writer and as a person. And it's like you said, like you wouldn't go back in time and be like, I never wrote this, haha. But you certainly wouldn't, as a person now, sit down and be like, yes, I'm going to write the Flesh Cartel exactly the same, or as, like you said, even at all.
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting, like the growing pains of being a writer, like, and especially because you do use one primary pen name, it's like everyone gets to see your evolution, everyone gets to see what you, you know, like a new genre you fall in love with or a genre you fall out of love with. And I think that's really cool, but it also, I think, could lead to a lot of, you know, angst on part of the author. I don't know if that's something you experience.
Absolutely. It really, really, it opens me up to, I guess, a lot of like regret, a lot of shame, a lot of questioning, just on the, like the, I feel like, you know, the internet is forever and I'm lucky that I'm basically like the last generation of people who kind of still maintain a little bit of privacy in my life. Like I said a lot of shitty things as a 14-year-old that now a 14-year-old on Tumblr would get like dragged through the mud for and live with for the rest of their life. But luckily, I was a shitty 14-year-old on LiveJournal, so
same.
You know, it's not really following me the same way.
No,
but when you're publishing books, now that really is following me, and sometimes you feel like a pressure to not change. Like on the one hand, I'm sitting here, and you know, I'm saying I wouldn't write the Flesh Cartel at this point in my life. And that's an honest statement that I'm making. But I feel like some people are saying, well, you did, so you can't take it back and you can't pretend that that's not you now, which I understand. And there's also people who are saying, well, what's wrong with the Flesh Cartel? Why do you want to grow bastard? Do you think you're better than me now? Like I read it and really enjoyed it. And now you're saying you don't want to write that anymore and you've grown out of it. So are you saying I should grow out of it? And I don't want to like offend my readers for the Flesh Cartel who've obviously found something to connect with in it. But at the same time, I have to be able to grow. And so it's a little weird. And, you know, sometimes I think to myself, like right now I'm writing my first lesbian novel and I'm thinking like, oh, you know, I should just start a new pen name. I can just throw Heidi Bellow out and like toss her in the garbage and move on. And then it's just like, I've spent so many years living as Heidi Bellow and, you know, made so many connections and told all these stories. And I don't really want to leave that behind at the same time. So it's really difficult to, you know, have that all on display. And so I feel like through my writing, I'm getting the 21st century experience of growing up on Tumblr instead of growing up on LiveJournal, where it has luckily mostly disappeared.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, like, I was in a pretty high profile fandom circle. So like, while most of it has disappeared, I'm still kind of like, oh, cool.
Like, I mean, if somebody had a grudge against me and like was really determined to dig up shit, I'm sure they could.
Yeah,
I'm sure they could. Because I haven't like expunged my LiveJournal from the internet. It's there. If you want to find it, you can find it. And, you know, obviously it's still there. But, you know, it's a lot more safe feeling for me than for someone who is living in this environment now, you know? Like, somebody would have to do a lot of work to dig me up.
Like, Tumblr doesn't have, you know, like, when you were on LJ, you had filters and friends lock, and you could privatize something, and it wasn't really index, like, you can't really index LiveJournal the way you can Tumblr. So, you know, for a little 14-year-old who's learning some shit and unlearning some shit, if they fuck up, it's forever. You know, that's why you see so many, you'll see so many posts where they get their ass handed to them, and then you click on their little Tumblr icon and they're gone, they're deactivated. And it's like, man, that's gotta be, I mean, I have some amount of sympathy for that. That's gotta be rough. And it's interesting too, like, the sort of long minds that fanish circles have, and then to see that reflected in publishing, in queer romance publishing, and I guess arguably indie publishing, is so strange, because in my mind I see it as such a separate entity. Like, to me it's a business and it's an industry, and yet there are people, so many people who come from these fandom roots who kind of keep that mentality and keep that sort of long memory associated with fandom. It's weird. Yeah. I'm into it, but it's weird.
On the one hand, I feel like a lot of the things I did as a 14-year-old deserved of being called out for. Like, you know, I had a lot of growing to do. I was a white 14-year-old girl. Absolutely. I said some really shitty stuff on the internet at one point. And I definitely feel like had someone came at me and told me, you're being a shitty person right now, like, I would have well deserved that. But on the other hand, it really is nice to have that freedom to grow past it and say, that was really wrong of me, but here I am now, take me as I am now. Whereas, you know, some people don't really have that opportunity. And I see both sides of it. I understand that, you know, sometimes you don't want to forgive someone for their past trespasses, and sometimes not being forgiven is hard sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't want to be like, oh, the Tumblr is the worst and I hate the SJWs. Because obviously that's not fucking true. I'm complete Tumblr trash and I'm totally an SJW. So, like, I feel like this conversation is making me sound like, oh, you know, if someone is a Nazi on Tumblr, we should just let them be. That's not really the case.
No, it's just more the, I mean, there's been so much meta on call out culture, and I mean, it's just sort of what happens when you get groups of people together and you have, you know, weird personal access to their thoughts. And in publishing especially, like, you know, queer romance is such a niche, and most of us feel like we're kind of in it together. And when someone steps out of line, you feel betrayed by that, because you're suddenly like, are we not in this together? Like, is this somebody who doesn't have, you know, the best interest of the community at heart? Like, I don't know. I think it's an interesting reflection of, I think, broader internet culture, because queer publishing is so internet based.
I feel like as an artist, going back to the idea that, you know, readers might feel betrayed or other folks might feel betrayed, I feel like as an artist, though, you have to have room to grow, because, you know, writing is work. And even if it's not about, like, oh, other people should feel bad for liking this thing I wrote, or other people should feel like they should grow up and stop enjoying this, it's more of a, like, you know, you have to keep doing your work. And, you know, improvement comes in all kinds of different ways, and sometimes that means going somewhere very different. And I mean, I look back on stuff that I have written, you know, years ago, and it's not that I think other people shouldn't like it, it's just that with any job you work in for 5-10 years, you're going to change, and you have to be able to.
Yeah, and you'll get better at it. I don't want to like weigh, you know, I guess fucking moralism or something, but the process of becoming a better author means shedding some of the things that have influenced or informed you. And when you look back at your work, not only do you see, like, oh shit, I really fucked up the pacing in that novel, or oh shit, my grammar's a lot better now, but you might be like, you know what? I don't actually want to write about that again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was, you know, I got a lot of success writing Dark Fix. So I definitely don't want to, like, bite the hand that feeds me. But, you know, I've had a lot of success doing it. But on the other hand, the success started to feel really bitter for me. I would message Rachel, and, you know, Rear Entrance Video did not sell as well as I was hoping it would sell. I had a very different image in my mind. So when I compare the sales of, say, like, Bliss or Flesh Cartel to Rear Entrance Video, it started to feel really frustrating to me, because on the one hand, I feel like Flesh Cartel was something I really needed to write. I talked about all the time when I was writing it, how it was an exorcism. I needed to get this story out of me, and now it's out and it's gone, and I'm free from it, I guess. But it was really frustrating to me to see the comparative success between my dark fiction and my romantic comedies, which are, you know, also books of my heart. And it felt sort of like, well, am I a one trick pony? Is this the thing that the world wants for me? Like, you will write rape and you will like it, and that is all you will ever do, and that is all we will ever praise you for doing. And especially as a survivor, it's just like, how fucking ruined am I as a human being if that's like, I've gone through my life and that's my fucking skill? Like, am I like a completely destroyed, soiled person? And so that was really frustrating. And I started to feel really bitter about writing it and angry about the sales it was getting. And it was just like, I just got to a point where I was like, I really need to take a step back from this. This is like, it is not giving me any joy. It's not giving me fulfillment. The exorcism is done, so I'm not getting that catharsis anymore. I turned very bitter and angry and frustrated. And thank God for Burnt Toast B&B, because that was like a complete like lemon meringue pie of a book. And I was expecting it to do very poorly because, you know, one, it was a romantic comedy, which I knew my romantic comedies didn't sell well, as well as my dark fiction. And two, it was a book with a transgender character. And, you know, of course, everyone says, oh, transgender characters don't sell. But Burnt Toast B&B actually sold really, really well. And, you know, people, and not just the money, but the response to it was so good and so warm. And so I suddenly felt like, hey, this is something I can write lighter stories and happier stories, and people will also be thankful for those and will also write me like love letters or, you know, fan mail, and will also talk it up. And, you know, it was the thing that validated, that said the light part of me is also good and also worthwhile. And I don't have to write dark fiction to pay my bills. And I don't have to write dark fiction to be recognized as an author. If I want to leave it behind, if I want to not be that person right now, I don't have to be anymore. So it was really freeing for me to know that, you know, I wasn't stuck only writing rape. It was just like, wow, like there was no rape in that book at all, and people still enjoyed it. And it's just like, holy shit, maybe I'm not a completely ruined, soiled person. Because when you're a survivor, that's really or for me at least, that's really the way I'm constantly framing things in my mind, is, am I a ruined person? Am I destroyed beyond repair? Am I broken? Da 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 da. So Burnt Toast B&B was like, maybe I'm not broken after all, and I can be this person as well.
It's not necessarily the same experience at all, but I know a lot of trans authors who have sort of gone in and they've written their like really, really painful book about a trans character, and like people eat that up and then they go, can I write something happy about being trans, or where people just like get to live maybe? And I think there's a similar feeling.
Well,
there.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you have a history of writing such dark fiction, it's such a sticky personal thing. Like, it's not something that you just sat down and hammered out like, this will sell. Like, it was, like you said, an exorcism, and, you know, it didn't come without its downsides, and the upsides just didn't outweigh that anymore. Like, the pleasure of having readers respond to something you wrote, the exorcism aspect of it, and then honestly, like, the financial gains, like, you hit a point in your career where all of those things did not outweigh how you felt about the negatives.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. It was always pros versus cons. It was always, is this helping me? Is this, you know, is this worth saying? And then it swung to the other side where it didn't feel good to write anymore, and it didn't feel good to talk about anymore. And so I really had to, and like Austin said, I think that's a really good point, that, you know, you can bury your trauma, but at a certain point you don't want to do it anymore, and you get so tired, and it's hard to like, you know, I get criticism of Flesh Cartel saying like, it's so materialistic and you're making money off of this. And a part of me is like, sort of like, well, you know what? Fuck you. I was like abused as a child, and if I want to make some money off of that experience, like, consider it my payment from the fucking universe for living a shitty life. But
yeah.
On the other hand, it does kind of hurt too to monetize your trauma and to lay it all out there and then have it reviewed and, you know,
like quantified.
Just commodified. That's exactly it. And sometimes you don't want to commodify your sadness and your pain anymore. So I can totally see the connection there.
And you shouldn't have to.
No, you really shouldn't. There should be literally no requirement whatsoever for a transgender person to have to write a traumatic story for them. I am all for trans people if they do not want to do that. If you want to write like every single story be like a happy, loving, sweet, like delightful transgender story with no transphobia in a universe where everything works out and you're happy and it's escapism and it's a fucking romance and it has a happily ever after. Like nobody should be punishing you for that. And you shouldn't be punishing yourself for that saying, oh, I shouldn't be writing this because it's not making the same money as writing, you know,
the angst porn,
dead transgender people, angst porn for a cis audience that thinks that's the only story that can or should be told.
This is why I fanboy.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I was thinking about this. We recently did an episode with Tracy Timmons Gray of GRNW, which if anyone listens to this podcast, they also know that among the many things we talk about, Heidi, KJ Charles, and GRNW, because we're fucking garbage people who only talk about three things ever. The reason we're having this podcast today, much like the sort of poetic, you know, nature of our entire lives, is because of GRNW. I met Heidi at GRNW the same year I met Austin at GRNW. And Heidi and I only see each other one time a year. We see each other in Seattle. And yet we've, you know, got this, I guess, internet and like, it's a hybrid friendship. It's internet and like one day a year, maybe 2 days a year friendship. And it's not that I didn't know who Heidi was or anything like that, but like the exposure to someone who gets up on a platform, because the first year you were on a panel talking about, I don't even remember what the panel was, but I remember very clearly that you have the mic and you were making points. And if I also remember correctly, Austin and I were in the audience like, preach, praise, bring it down.
I remember you in the audience like taking us panelists to task. I'm pretty sure you asked an FF question. You were like, yeah. Hey, so where's the queer women representation in this fucking panel and in this conference? And it was just like, I admired your balls.
You admired my balls and you admired my galaxy print leggings, which I still
own. I did admire your galaxy print leggings. Your galaxy print leggings totally brought us together.
They did. They're the reason.
That panel was, I believe, on the future of the queer romance genre. I believe that was like the official title, but it really skewed towards conversations about diversity. Like that was definitely a focus of it. In amongst talking about changes in the genre and changes in marketing and changes in presses that we were seeing and changes in what's the word? Technology matters a lot. So it was like a big panel with a lot of questions and very little time to answer them.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I think it's important that that inaugural, you know, GRNW with that type of a panel led to the sort of programming we're seeing now, which is reflective of, wow, I fucking sound like the world's worst announcer, but it really, I mean, it's reflective of the genre changing. Like, it's changing and we have to change with it. You know, this kind of stories that are traditionally told about, you know, say trans people are not necessarily the stories that should be, you know, primarily told in the future. Like we shouldn't be saying the same old tired shit about like, well, trans books don't sell. And we shouldn't be saying the same old tired shit about FF, which is like FF presses handle their own shit. And you know what I mean? Like it's everything's changing and authors owe it to themselves and their readership to reader shit.
Whoa.
They owe it to their readership to change with it. And I think in a weird sort of roundabout way, that might be what you're doing. Like, not that, you know, I don't think that your grimdark stuff is really on that same level, but it's more like, okay, well, I've told these stories. These stories have been told. They're there for the audience. As an author, I needed to say something else. And what you need to say is like a lesbian novel that's like, you know, I've actually read the first, what is it, like 30K of your lesbian novel?
Yeah, around there, I think, yeah.
Yeah, right around there. And it's so, like, it's so definitely your sensibility, and I won't, you know, talk about it at length, because it's still top secret, but, like, it's definitely, like, a lighter fare, but it's still got your sort of, you know, your touch of depth to it. And to have, you know, an author with a history of selling pretty popular books write something that isn't as sellable, like Burnt Toast B&B. Again, it's like, oh, well, trans romance doesn't sell, and Burnt Toast B&B did B&D. Jesus Christ. Me speaking today
is B&D.
B&D. Burnt Toast is one of those... it's just fucking devolving. Burnt Toast is one of those books... is one of those books that, you know, is the face or a face of what the queer romance genre is sort of evolving into, because everybody's read the same old stories over and over again, and everyone sort of wants to take it to a more transformative and current place. So I am excited to see what the genre will look like in 5 years and to see how many authors will sort of see it through. Because I feel like, you know, you struggled so much with deciding how to continue as an author and what you were going to write and if you were going to write at all. And to find, you know, oh, wait, actually, there's this entire new realm of stories I can tell about lesbians and bi women and trans people. And they're all, you know, on the lighter side. Like, that is just as valid, if not more valid, than the stuff that you sort of spent years toiling in the mines over. Like, the mines. The mines of non-con. The non-con mines.
The non-con mines, yeah. I was going to say the rape mines, which just sounds so terrible.
All I can think of is the fucking mines of Moria, and I'm just like, no, Amanda, no. Stop.
I know. I was about to go into the Gimli speech.
I know. I won't. Drums in the dark. No, in the deep. Drums in the deep. Fuck.
Wow. And they call it a mine. A mine.
This better be in the anyway. Outtakes. That needs to be in the outtakes. Or in the actual episode. I don't know. It'll be up to our audio producer.
To bring it back to the evolution of the genre, I was at RT last week and was sitting on a panel that Amy Jo Cousins was speaking on about crossover fiction and people who are writing male-female or female-female or menage as well as male-male. And like, there was a big conversation about switching genres and should you switch pen names and how much crossover is there. And Amy Jo Cousins said something that really connected with me. And she said, you know, right now the crossover isn't happening that much. She says, you know, she's got an audience for her male books, and you know, she's doing that new adult series with Samhain. It's so hard to say Samhain instead of Samhain, but Samhain. She's doing this series with Samhain that's mixed orientation, and she's got one male female book in the middle there with a really great cover and like a super hot girl on the front. And she like openly said, like, that book does not get the sales that the male ones in the series do. The male readers are not crossing over to read this male-female book as a whole, because there's obviously going to be some exceptions to the rule. But she was really strongly saying that that's the way the genre is going to go. She really, and I agree with her completely, that is our future. Our future is going to be mixed orientation. We're going to stop worrying about lady bits. We've already started to stop worrying about lady bits. This genre has changed so much since I came in 2011. It's unbelievable. But I really think people are going to start actually living by the phrase love is love that gets thrown out around in the male genre all the time, and actually start living by those words and understanding that love stories are love stories regardless of orientation or the gender alignment of the main characters. So I really think that's, like, in my mind, that is the future of our genre, is that we're really going to start seeing readers not being hesitant to try different orientations. And we're going to start seeing readers who, and authors who are going to be willing to say, I'm not going to listen when everyone tells me FF doesn't sell. So keep writing, you know, White Cock forever. They're going to just say, you know what? I don't want to write White Cock anymore and I don't have to. And, you know, they're going to take that step of not writing White Cock and they're going to discover, hey, actually, people are perfectly happy not reading White Cock, and hooray, everything is going to get better. So, Amy Jo Cousins was the one that, you know, vocalized that for me.
Preach.
I had a thought, and I'm trying to remember what the fuck it was, but I kept cracking up at White Cock.
White Cock.
Sounds like a beverage, like a mysterious cocktail. Like, if you want White Cock,
shut up.
Wow. Y'all.
It's time to wrangle us, Austin. Wrangle us back.
Yeah, I'm gonna wrangle us into the next topic since we've gone 45 minutes on this.
Shh, I don't want to hear your fucking judgment.
I'm gonna wrangle us into kink, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Oh no. Oh no, my least favorite topic.
You're like, oh, if I must.
So kink, writing kink. How's that?
It's great. I love it.
This is the sound of Austin giving up.
No, how's it different from not writing kink?
There we go. Thank you. Well, I'm trying to, you know, the thing that I have to do in my career now is to separate kink from non-con, because, you know, I write, like, I've talked a lot about how I write fiction with rape in it, and it's rape fiction, it's not meant for titillation, and I write non-con, which is meant for titillation or thrills and chills or whatever. And so at times non-con really is a kink, but kink very easily exists outside of non-con, and, you know, in the real world obviously should exist with consent at all times.
Yes.
So, you know, that's been my new thing is, you know, writing light fiction or lighter fiction that doesn't have that non-con or that rape element, but also has kink, but is also funny. So funny kink is sort of like the thing that I'm down with right now. So my female-female novel that I'm doing right now is like, I'm really into exploring kink from this light, consensual, constantly negotiating boundaries kind of thing without making it like really serious and dry and BDSM 101, like, let's go over the rules of safe, sane, and consensual, my esteemed partner. But, you know, like, in a way that's
what
very...
What do you take if it's a hard limit?
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to do that. But yeah, to write kink in the context of, like, you know, a fluffy, happy, sweet story between two women. And so there are those power play elements and, you know, a little bit of bossiness and all the things that I really enjoy. So I'm really having fun exploring comedic kink and hopefully comedic BDSM as the days go by. I think I almost got there with Straight Shooter. Like, there were some funny parts mixed in with the BDSM, but because Austin was such a suffocating character to live in the head of, I think he kind of ruined the humor of the book a lot because he was like so miserable constantly.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Stop talking about me like this, Heidi.
You know, I just don't want to live with you anymore, Austin. I want to get out of your head and leave.
I actually, the other week, we were talking about Straight Shooter, and I don't remember in what context, but I was like, no, Straight Shooter, and I sort of squinted, and I was like, what was the main character's name in that? And Austin looked at me and was like, Austin. And I was like, oh.
Did I write something sassy to you to that effect? Because didn't you bring me a copy of Straight Shooter for me to sign at JRNW 1 year? And I like wrote, I'm pretty sure I wrote something sassy about it in there. Or if I didn't write something sassy, I really wanted to write something sassy.
I think it was on Twitter, because I actually am still missing the physical copy of Straight Shooter. I have to add it to my collection next year.
You do have a collection. But, you do actually do.
But I remember on Twitter, because I opened the book and I was like, oh no, Heidi. It was right after I chose this pen name and I was like, Austin, I'm getting comfortable with Austin. And I was like, what's this fucked up kinky book that I'm going to read? It's about me.
Surprise.
Yourself a hockey player.
A buff hockey player, like really buff. So that's good.
Yeah.
I'm describing all the things I'm not.
He's like really ripped. He has like a hot boyfriend.
Yeah, it's true.
Keep listing the things I don't have, Heidi.
Fucking straight shooter, man. I read that in like a sitting and a half, which is how I read most things. And that is a really intense fucking book. Like, I don't know, because the Rev series is not that intense. Like, Wallflower gets intense, but I would say Straight Shooter is more intense. And definitely Apple Polisher is, you know, pretty light. So I wasn't prepared. I wasn't ready.
They went darker as they went along. Like, Apple Polisher was, like, super light. It was really fluffy. It's just, you know, a guy who's really, like, concerned about his image and, you know, da-da-da-da, he's uptight, he has to work at a porn store, like, haha, it's such a sitcom setup. And then the second book, it's like, okay, now we're going to do this setup, but we're going to do a transgender character. And, you know, once again, talking about things that you wouldn't do at this point in time, like, Wallflower is so about the trans experience. And, you know, as I've grown as an author and actually, like, you know, spent more time with trans people, I'm starting to realize that that's really not a book for a cisgender person to really be writing. So, you know, mea culpa on that one. But, you know, obviously, because I was writing the trans experience, it had to get a little bit more serious, because otherwise, like, writing a jokey book about it would be even shittier of me. And then by the third book, it was like, I initially really pitched it as being like a slapstick kind of comedy. Like, I said to Sarah, I'm like, oh, there's Sarah Lyons from Riptide. I mean, I said to her, I said, oh, you know, I'm going to write this book and it's going to be about a straight guy who like is really kinky and his love, like his number one kink is being dominated by a man because, you know, he's got all these issues and, you know, but he's super kinky and he has to like deal with the fact that he's like, you know, having sex with men for kink and da da da. And I like played it off as like, you know, like, haha, joke funny, like, lol, straight man, get it up the butt, ha ha ha. And then I wrote the book and it was just like fucking miserable. Like, when I think of the experience of writing Straight Shooter and the experience of writing Flesh Cartel, I feel like Straight Shooter was actually more difficult and painful for me to write.
I could see that.
It was really hard to exist inside of Austin's head, especially because it wasn't a dual POV book. It was just like relentless, and he was just constantly going in circles and constantly saying shitty things about himself and everyone else. He was such a shitty character to, like, I love him because he's my baby, but he was such a shitty fucking character to have to exist inside. And I always say, like, everyone's, you know, reviews or readers will come to me and say, oh, you know, the book really picks up when Liam got there. And it's like, yeah, when you feel that pick me up, that's my like palpable relief at being able to leave Austin a little bit. Like, when Liam came onto the, like, you know, the narrative feels relieved when he comes into the book, I felt relieved. It was like, oh, thank God Liam is in this scene and I can just like have a fucking break. Cause that's the way that book fucking felt. It really,
I actually remembered how we were talking about Austin last week. It was, we were doing an episode on villains. And on characters who are their own villains. Of which my primary example was Straight Shooter.
Yeah, someone who fucks themselves up and stands in their own way.
Yeah, it's a really surprising book for me to write, because, you know, Austin was kind of a shithead through the other two books. Like, the first book, he's kind of like, you know, a meathead and sort of like a little bit aggravating, but sort of like he doesn't really play into the story a lot, so you like, you see him and you're like, ugh, that guy, but it's not. And then in the second book, when he starts being shitty to Bobby, you're like, fuck that guy, I want that guy dead. And and then at that point I had to be like, oh, but he's the main character of book three and I've set him up as like a complete shithead that nobody likes. So that
the
was
hard
fun.
Sell with Heidi.
And, you know, I don't really like, it's actually one of my real flaws as an author, is I'm not super good at writing, like, really, like, people, like, often comment on my villains being, like, other than Nikolai from Flesh Cartel, which I feel like people really like him, but, like, generally my villains are like, accused of being cartoonish, and that's because I have a very cartoonish way of thinking, in that people, if they are bad, they are bad, and I don't want to sympathize with bad people, so it really bleeds into my writing. I write bad people who are very bad and always bad, and, you know, I have a really hard time doing what I'm supposed to do, which is, like, make the villain the hero of his own story. Like, Flesh Cartel's kind of the exception to the rule on that for me. Like, you know, Dead Ringer, the villains in Dead Ringer are just like cartoonishly terrible, just awful people. And so with Austin, I had to really push past that, where I'd created a character who could very easily be a caricature of, like, you know, a shithead meathead jock who is homophobic and an asshole and garbage, and why are we spending time with him? And I had to force myself to make him at least sympathetic enough that I could carry a book with him in as the lead. I think the kink was actually what really helped humanize him, I think. Because yeah. Once you got inside his head and you saw this kinkiness and you saw, like, that really helped to humanize him in a way that otherwise he could have very easily just been a flat homophobic jock character. And that's really the way he came across originally. So that was fun.
Well, it gives him something to want that's very contrary to that sort of the shitty dude persona he's got going on. When you get into his head and you see that kind of craving, it gives you a very different idea of that character.
Yeah, and that's just one of the ways that, like, kink can really enrich a book for me. It can really be, just make it good. And to be honest, you know, my entire attitude to writing sex, I'm sorry if this is TMI, but if I'm not turned on by what I'm writing, I know my readers aren't going to be turned on by it. So I just write what gets me hot. Like, I really don't write something I'm like, I never sit down and I'm like, okay, I'm, you know, this sells really well. People really like werewolves, so I'm going to write a werewolf, and I guess I'm going to make it ABO because people really like ABO. If I'm going to write ABO, it's because I fucking love ABO, okay? Like, that's the deal for me. I'm sorry if that's going to ruin your experience of this book, that you're going to open my next book and be like, oh God, because you're going to be thinking about me the whole time. But that's the reality. So there's a lot of kink and power play in my books because that just happens to be one of my, like, fantasies. So it gets put into all my books. Even my not kinky books have those elements of power play in them right from the beginning. There's always somebody who kind of comes across a little bit bossier, who, you know, tells another person and, you know, orders them around. And I try to not keep it along traditional MM top bottom lanes. I try to, you know, do my bossy bottoms and everything else, but I definitely get that power play in all the time.
Yeah, I love a good power play story. I am a person who, like, I'm a little bit different in that I don't tend to write what I'm into. Like, I'm sure there's been crossover, but it's more like my brain goes to some separate place where I'm like, these are what do it for the characters. Although I am struggling, the stripper fic that I sent you, I'm struggling with that because I made the main character's kink, like, voyeurism, and he's a very retiring, like, inward person. Like, he's very internal. And I'm like, how the fuck do I, like, I don't, that's not my kink isn't watching. So how do I do this for, like, a little weird introvert? I'm like, I don't know, I'll figure it out. Fucking stripper story. It's ruining my whole life.
Look, listen, here's my deal. If there's a sex worker in it, I am down for it 100%. Like, that's it. Bulletproof. Like, especially if I can know that it's not going to be, like, a shitty treatment of a sex worker, then I'm definitely down.
Yeah, one of the reasons I avoid many books with sex workers in them is not because of, like, any personal thing. It's just that I feel like the author might really fuck up, and I don't want to put myself through that. Like I'd feel kind of slimy reading it because it is an insidious, like, bias and stigma. And people, you know, people, even when they're trying to write, like, the cute, uplifting, like, oh, I'm writing about, you know, a stripper or an escort or something, like, there's a lot of weird stuff that can get in there. And I'm actually going to be very careful when I select a beta and stuff to be like, please tell me if I fucked up, because I probably did.
Yeah. I'm very strong proponent of, like, you know, if I have a person of color in my books, I'm always going to find a beta reader for that. And if, like, I had a disability beta for Dead Ringer, and yeah, like a sex worker beta, a completely reasonable thing to include as a beta. Absolutely. Because there are tropes that sex workers don't want to read, and, you know, you can enact cultural violence against them with these narratives. Like, even though they're, like, our fluffy forbidden fantasy, for them that's their life, and you can't be shitty about their life, and you can't contribute to that stigma through your writing. It's really not fair.
Yeah, the last thing I want to do is perpetrate, like, more dehumanization on a sex worker with my, like, cute, you know, with my cute commodified story about their livelihood that isn't my life. Like, it would be one thing if I were writing the story as a sex worker, but I'm not one, so I'm having to, you know, write it from the outside, attempting to look in. And I also, my main character is mixed race, and I need a beta for that too. So I'm just like, that entire project is just me like gritting my teeth going like, oh God, don't fuck up. Just don't. But I feel like if I let myself acknowledge that I'm going to fuck up, it's easier to write, because someone, like we talked about earlier, like your beta reader, your editor, you know, somebody's probably going to catch it. I wouldn't say that that's true 110% of the time, but somebody along the line, if you've done your work, will catch you falling into a shitty trap. So we've espoused the virtue of beta readers, especially like diverse, quote unquote, beta readers before. But I think, you know, like when you're writing a story like Dead Ringer, you definitely need to have someone in your corner making sure that there's not something in there that will bite a disabled character in the ass. And for me, like, I don't want to write something super fucking racist, and I don't want to write something, you know, super dehumanizing and shamey. These are the things that keep writers and editors awake at night. It's just like, did I fuck up? Am I making it worse?
You know, and a beta reader is no assurance either. Like, you know, I would never speak down to like the work that beta readers do, especially like, you know, sensitivity readers. They do excellent and important work, and, you know, it's labor worth paying for and worth honoring and acknowledging. But on the other hand, especially if you are only able to afford one beta reader, you're obviously not going to be able to avoid all instances of fucking up. And different people have different definitions of fucking up. What one person thinks is acceptable, say about Wallflower. I know that I had a beta reader on Wallflower and, you know, went through that and, you know, did my very best, but there are still people who have responded to it with, no, these elements were very problematic and et cetera. And that's just something that happens. And, you know,
yeah, because experiences aren't universal.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's no way of insulating yourself against it. You just have to kind of do your absolute best job. And if you're not willing to do your absolute best job, then don't fucking do it.
To tie that back into kink, actually, I wonder how many people actually get like kinky betas. Like if they get someone who's a sub or a top, or, you know, like what's going on in their book probably needs to be vetted too. Because I was thinking about like all of the times I've eye-rolled at really bad BDSM or bad kink, and I just realized like maybe they just didn't research it. Like maybe they just didn't do all of the work.
I think about Amelia Gormley a lot because, you know, she's been very open about the fact that she's evolved in the kink lifestyle as a person. And, you know, she talks about like her experience in the kinky lifestyle versus what I think the term is glitter kink is the tropey term, where like everyone's beautiful and they all go to this upscale BDSM club that's super hush hush. And like all the women are size 2 and all the men are ripped and there's never any like creeps in among them. And there's, and it's just like, no, BDSM is a place for fat people, and it is a place for people who are gender nonconforming, and it is a place for people who don't have money for upscale clubs or $1 million sex dungeons. Like, so I think I don't want to say that portraying kink harmfully is the same as like, say, writing a really terrible stereotyped black character, obviously. But you can definitely do some damage, especially on the consent front. If what you're purporting to be writing is healthy kink and you're not writing healthy kink, but you're pretending it's healthy kink, that's an issue. Like I've written bad kink with bad, like people who are bad at kink. You know, obviously some people are not going to read that at all because they only want to read what's safe and consensual. But on the other hand, I hope that I portray that, you know, Professor's Rule is a good example. The professor and his sub in the first book, they involve someone in their play without like alerting him to that was what was happening. And that's a really shitty thing to actually do. Like, obviously I would never fucking recommend that in a million years. Like that's not appropriate or right. And so, you know, through the course of the narrative, it comes out that like, that's a shitty thing to do to a person. And, you know, that person wound up actually being a character who had a voice who said, that was really fucked up what you did, and I'm really upset with you about it. But, you know, had that story stood alone like it was originally going to, I think it would have really portrayed a bad thing about kink and consent. Like, it was meant to be as a fantasy, and as a fantasy, it's okay to have, like, a threesome fantasy or a voyeurism fantasy or anything else. But, like, when people start to take their kink lessons from it and say, okay, so this is how it goes in real life, and this is how I should treat my partners, then, like, there's a difference between writing a flawed dom who's a flawed dom and writing a flawed dom that you're portraying as a really good dom, even though he's shitty.
Yeah, that's I struggle with that as a romance reader and a romance editor, because I've had discussions with various, like, editor-in-chiefs about, hey, so the story I'm editing has some really, like, bad kink aspects, and I called them out, but I feel like the author isn't going to want to change them. And this has happened, like, a lot, actually. And the sort of final answer is, like, well, this is fiction. Like, this doesn't have to be, like, adhering to safe, sane, consensual. It doesn't have to be perfect. It can be fantasy. But at the same time, like, I understand that. I just feel like that kind of needs to be maybe labeled, or it needs to be evident in some aspect. Like, you don't necessarily have to call it out in the marketing, but I am a person who thinks that what media you consume affects you. And if you are a person who's never been exposed to kink or BDSM in an arena that isn't fictional or isn't fantastical, like, that isn't, you know, the romanticized version of it, like, you may be taking some things away from that that aren't great for you. Or if you decide to engage in kink based on what you read in a book, like, that's maybe not the safest way to go about it.
It's really a hard line to walk, especially as an erotica author. When I put my erotica author hat on, it's really hard to balance. I don't want to write something that's irresponsible, but I also, like, sometimes the requirements that, like, this is one of my pet peeves, is people who are in the lifestyle who, like, just shit on fantasy BDSM entirely. Like, that's nothing like what we experience. Only real kinksters should be writing this. And I'm a real kinkster, so you can trust my opinion of this. And, you know, we shouldn't write BDSM books with bad doms in them, because that's bad. And I understand that on one standpoint, because you don't want uninitiated people getting the wrong idea. From the other standpoint, I don't want to write about good doms all the time. Like, that, I like to write characters who grow and who make mistakes and who aren't always good and who make missteps. But when you also have that other responsibility, it's harder to balance between not writing a character who is perfect at his kink and who also always asks for consent at the right time and who is always thoughtful and listening and who doesn't read minds because mind reading doesn't actually exist, and wanting to write a fantasy story where you let go of that real
things
world.
Just go well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's tough. And I really do feel like there needs to be some kind of labeling or some way of portraying that, you know, this is real world kink where, you know, everything is safe, sane, consensual. And, you know, we negotiate constantly and there's discussion of safe words. It's, you know what? It's really similar to the argument about condoms in male-male romance, which is like, you know, there's a responsibility to portray safe sex. And on the other hand, sometimes you just want to get off without thinking about condoms. And, you know, if you're into cum, you want to have the cum be a part of the story and not be inside of a condom. And, like, you kind of, it's hard to meet those two, the fantasy versus the real world responsibility. How do we connect those? Do we need to connect those? Do we just need to label them and say, like, this is a fantasy, you know, because sometimes you just want to write a story with cum play without, like, doing the whole thing, where you, like, specify, like, yes, I went and got tested 2 days ago and here are my results. Like, not to say that anyone who writes that is a shitty writer, but sometimes you don't want to be the person who's writing it. Like, I don't want to be the person who writes that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to say that it can never be done well and nobody can ever write it and have it be super hot, but that is not me, and I have not.
I read that, actually, that exact scenario in a really hot story one time, and I can't remember what it was, but it was, like, this UST of, like, these characters who were, like, thinking about sleeping with each other, and them getting tested and getting the results was, like, a part of the UST, and I was like, see, someone did this really well! Like, it wasn't just like, okay, well, you gotta get tested, like, which we talked about this in our Anatomy of a Sex Scene episode, is, like, Austin and I, or at least I don't remember how much agreement was on this side, because we argue that entire episode, was I was basically just like, I'm really pro safe sex, and if I'm reading a story that isn't like fantasy or pre-negotiated or whatever, and there's like like a hookup and there's no mention of protection, like there's no mention of anything, it yanks me out and I'm just like worried. I'm like, is everyone okay? Is everyone good? Do you need condoms? I can drop off condoms. It's fine. Like, do you need a dental dam? I'm good.
Yeah. And I'm the exact opposite. It's just like, you know, when I'm reading, you know, some stories I'm going to expect safe sex to be addressed, and other stories, it's sort of like, can we not slow down the fucking with all this like real world stuff? Like, I just really want to get to the rest of it.
I feel like it super depends for me on what I'm reading too. Like, if I'm reading something and I feel like those characters would be conscious of that, then it might jar me out. If I'm like, wait a minute, but 10 minutes ago Billy was really responsible and was thinking about these
fucking
things.
Fucking all the names you come up with, your fucking fake names. It's Billy this time.
Look. Billy and if I think that Leander would reasonably not behave that way, then
Christ.
Then it might be jarring for me. Anyway, whatever. You know what I mean.
I think it also really depends on tone, like the whether the tone is a realistic tone or if it's very much like a fantasy kind of tone. You can kind of get across.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like your realistic story might have some limitations. I'm kind of grappling this with the FF right now, because on the one hand, I'm writing a realistic story that kind of like basks in its realism. Like, the heroine wears Spanx and doesn't shave her legs because she's pregnant and, you know, that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, like, if I'm going to be writing oral, I'm not writing a fucking dental dam. So there is a limit. I can, like, ladies with hairy legs, no problem. Dental dams, hard limit. And for other people, it would be like, oh, there's no dental dam in this scene. This is not realistic to queer women's sex at all. I'm not doing a dental dam, no.
You're like, that is the place, that's the hill Heidi's dying on, dental dam.
It is the fucking hill, dental dam hill. You can write that down.
From dental dam hill, you can see the non-con mines. I'm the worst person I know. Oh,
So from dental dam hill, can you see the next topic for the podcast?
Actually, you know what? The next topic was going to be co-writing, but I feel like we don't actually have the time for that. And she did get into it a little bit. Unfortunately, we are talky motherfuckers.
I mean, I would love to hear, Heidi, if you have more to talk about with your FF novel, because I know that's the future.
That's the future of Heidi and the future of the genre.
Okay, well, I can tell you that it is about a fat bisexual woman, and I can tell you that she falls for a tiny pocket butch who is like 5 feet tall.
Yes.
It's my thing, okay? It's my thing. And I can tell you that I'm going to get hate mail for it and probably maybe even letter bombs, because it is a very, very pro-choice book. Pocket butch heroine is a clinic escort who has had an abortion in her past. Heroine is considering an abortion at the beginning of the book and decides against it. But my main concern was I didn't want to write a narrative where it felt, you know, judgy of, I didn't want to write a book that would be comfortable for anti-choice people to read. I did not want to write a book where it's like, oh, she's thinking about abortion, but she changed her mind, and that means it's a book for us. Because it's not a book for anti-choices at all. So, you know, you've got this clinic escort, heroine, love interest. You've got Planned Parenthood provides her prenatal care. You've got really nasty portrayals of anti-choice protesters, which was a particular delight for me to write, because fuck them. So yeah, you know, it's a story about a young pregnant woman who has her life completely out of fucking order and has really unrealistic expectations of herself and of motherhood, who basically learns from her love interest how to chill the fuck out.
And also, notably, you are forgetting a very crucial element to this story.
Oh, sorry, what am I forgetting?
Knitting.
Yeah, oh yeah, and they knit.
Hey.
they meet at a Tuesday night stitch and bitch that is advertised in the Planned Parenthood. And there are some sensual learning to knit scenes where the knitting is just a way for them to touch one another.
I'm delighted.
It's also in first person and present tense because I decided to just completely throw my entire history as an author out the fucking window.
See, yeah, you write a good first person. I'm actually pretty, I'm not a huge first person fan, but like when I opened it up and saw it was first person present, I was like, oh, I'm glad it's Heidi. Like,
yeah, I don't, listen, I wrote that first passage. That was like the sort of the spark of the story for me was that first passage where she introduces herself and introduces the story and stuff like that. And she talks about it very frankly, like in a way that like kind of breaks the fourth wall a little, like I'm a person telling you a story about this experience. And I wrote it in first person and I was like, fuck, I don't want to write a fucking book in first person present tense. What am I doing? But then I tried to write it in third person past tense, which is generally what I do when I write books. Like my entire backlist is third person past tense. And I tried to rewrite it and it sounded like utter shit. And it was just like, welp.
There you go.
And
got your first.
So it is a first person present tense book. And I think it completely serves the narrative and I really enjoy it because I think this heroine has a really great voice and I'm having like a shitload of fun writing her, unlike Austin from Straight Shooter. I just want to reiterate that I hated every moment of that book. No, I loved it, but I hated it.
Like, I love that it's done.
I love first present, so I'm excited.
Fucking club.
Yeah, fight me, Amanda.
I will.
Let's
fight
go
you.
Outside right now.
Natasha North's first female book, lesbian book, also is in first person present tense, and we did not coordinate that. We discussed the fact that we were both writing our first lesbian books at the same time, and you know we're both bisexual women. We had a long conversation about imposter syndrome. We talked about like how nervous we were to go from writing male to writing this lesbian fiction, and we were like so scared. We were like sharing this experience. And the whole time, I had no idea that she was also writing first person present tense. And she did. I just saw an excerpt and she did. And it's like, oh, so we're like mind linked.
You want to know something really weird? Is my only long, like, novel length FF project is also in first person present tense.
You know, maybe we're on to something.
Yeah.
Wave of the future.
I just edited two books for a lesbian press, and I'm trying to remember if either of them were first person present.
We may have stumbled upon a secret of the universe here.
Shit. I love that I'm like, I just edited two novels, and I can't remember which POV or tense they were in. Awesome. Good job, Amanda.
It's gone from your mind forever.
So. They're both done, so it's like my brain went, oh, okay, next project. Actually, I just started, not just, I've edited FF quite a bit, but I've just started working for a dedicated FF press, and that has been really fun, and it's one of the reasons I started to work for an FF press was because I was kind of like, I'm done with white cock. like I'm not
I'm
done
glad
with
to
it.
Bring up white cock one more time.
I have a revolving door relationship with white cock, but I was in the mood for something that wasn't entirely that. Not that, you know, not that I have anything against it or whatever, but
disclaimer.
Yeah, I don't know. I like my tastes have changed as an author and editor and a reader over the last, how long have I been in this industry? Since I've been reading queer romance since I was a fucking child, but I've been working in it since like January 2013, so a couple years, and it's changed pretty dramatically. So I think that
it really has. It has changed a lot. I remember entering this genre in 2011 with Druid Stone, coming into it, and it being like, you cannot have a female character in this book with a vagina. And I remember it being like a really controversial statement for me to say, I'm not going to warn for vaginas in my books. And I remember review sites openly rejecting reviews of my books because they had women who had sex in them. And I feel like the court of public opinion in male has really swung away from that. Like, you've definitely still got people who are like, not surprised, vaginas, but like, it's no longer a controversial statement for me to say, actually, I'm going to have vaginas in this book, whether you like it or not. And I feel like that we've moved away from that. Those people are now the minority. And that's the controversial statement to say, you know, I'm a cisgender woman, but I can't read about a vagina in a book. And I can't allow a bisexual character to have that whole fluid experience represented.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's also like, well, you know, a lot of, like, MM readers don't read stories with trans men in them, and they don't like bisexual stories. They like gay for you. So I love that this has just turned into a shaming session. What accessible, nice
reader
human beings
shaming.
We are.
Reader shaming.
If I see, like, one more review of, like, a book with a trans man in it, where, like, he's with a cis dude, and it's like, this is MF, I will shame someone so hard, they will never come back.
Yeah, I have some shaming. Bertos B&B, you know, because Ginsberg's, the fact that he's transgender isn't actually relevant to the plot at any point, it's not mentioned in the blurb. Like, obviously Riptide has a tagging system, so it's tagged transgender. When you search transgender, it appears. When you, like, look at the metadata for the book, which they have easily accessible on their website, you see that it is a transgender story about a transgender character. But the blurb doesn't say trans man Ginsberg, it's just Ginsberg. And so it was kind of like surprise trans for readers who didn't really, like, research it beforehand. So I definitely got some reviews for it that were a little less than charitable about Ginsberg, and it was just like, well, it's not for you anyway.
Yeah, it's rough, man. It's rough to still be engaging with an audience that doesn't really want what you're producing. Like,
I gotta say, this year has been particularly hard, just because of the, like, we just had, like, a month straight of people shitting on bisexuals. I don't know, like, what was in the water for that month, but it just, like, every day I woke up and it was more shit, and it was so fucking exhausting. And it just felt like, you know, y'all are, like, right up on the Love is Love and the rainbow banners on your websites and, you know, reading MM because it frees you from gender roles and from patriarchy and all the other things that you say about it. And then it's just like, it feels like you say those things, but I felt very unwelcome. I felt like a genre that I thought was for and about me really was for and about someone else. And that was a hard time to be a queer author in this genre. Like, it's never easy. There's always issues. But that was a really hard month for a lot of us, I think. And a lot of us were, like, on the verge of, I quit. That month, like, it was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I'd rather write male female books for straight people than write queer books for straight people, because at least if I'm writing male female books, the straight people are the audience and they're what it's about, and, you know, for to center them doesn't feel quite as shitty for queer books to have to center straight people and their sensibilities. And I'm talking about straight people, but I should really say that, like, you know, cisgender gay men are also shitty to bisexuals, and cisgender lesbians are also shitty to bisexuals at times. It's not like straight people obviously are, like, numero uno enemy in that front, but you definitely get it from all sides.
Quote Heidi Below, 2016. Straight people, definitely.
Numero uno enemy.
Public enemy number one.
It was a weird thing because I'm a very chill person. Like, my background comes from reading a lot of MM because that was all I could find when I was a wee babe. I could find a little bit of lesbian fiction. Most of it was, like, literary or just straight up porn. And then I found, like, the stories I was looking for as a queer person in, like, MM, and it was specifically gay. There were very few bisexual characters. And so I've always kind of had a, like, live and let live attitude about it. I've never really had too many opinions about the way that the demographic breaks down of readership. But now, like, having been through sort of the wars in this industry, like, coming out on the other side of feeling
the discourse
the discourse wars, like, coming out on the other side of that as a bi person, I'm kind of just like, I don't know, I don't like coming to the startling realization that many of the stories about myself are not for me. And I kind of always knew that, but it got to a point where I was like, I have to face this reality and I can't be quite so chill about it, because I never want to shame people for what they read, despite the many times I do that. It's more like, you know, I have my opinions and, you know, I have, in this case, a platform to talk about them, but I'm never going to, like, go and yell at someone for having an opinion different than mine. This is sort of an opt-in situation. But in this case, I was ready to yell at anyone in a 5-mile vicinity about bisexuality and just erasure and feeling elbowed out of your own community. And I don't like feeling like that in the genre where I live and work.
Yeah, I came to Mail Mail Romance, I guess, under the mistaken opinion that it was going to be a safe space, and it was not a safe space. And that month, it was like a distinctly unsafe space. That's hard to come to terms with, to know that this is a place that you think you're going to be safe and you think you're going to be celebrated because there's rainbows everywhere and everyone's saying love is love. And then you get there and it's just like bisexual people don't belong here and your books about them don't belong. And
yeah, because like, oh, okay. it's again, like the prefacing, you know, like the in queer romance spaces, primarily it's about the G. And all the other letters are like, well, if you're lucky, like, if you're lucky, and you're extra lucky if it's not weird and toxic.
Well, and it's just, it's bizarre. I think a lot of us come into these spaces going like, well, this might not be about me, but like, in theory, if I get more comfortable with myself and I want to read more stories that are about me, you know, this will be the space that's welcoming to that. And then you have readers who are like, well, a trans person fucks up my definition of what MM or FF is, or a bisexual person screws up my idea of what I guess queer love is, and now I'm gonna be a shit about it. And it's like, this is not what I signed up for.
No.
None of us signed up for this.
No. On that pleasant note.
I just wonder, I don't know what's going to happen in the future of this genre. That month, I really strongly started feeling like queer romance was going to leave male-male fiction behind and it was going to be its own thing. And the rest of us were just going to have to go somewhere else and make our own thing. An inclusive crossover genre with multi-orientations and, you know, a explicitly safe space for, you know, bisexual and transgender readers and writers and characters. And I don't know. I don't know if male-male genre is going to grow as it has grown or if it's just going to get left behind.
Yeah, I feel like we're at a crossroads looking at which way this genre could go if it becomes completely split, like MM remains its own thing. With its own, you know, set of demographics and its own set of tropes, or if it becomes even more inclusive. Because I honestly use queer romance pretty interchangeably when I mean something more specific, but I would not mind having it be its own thing. I think that was what made it solidify for me, is like, oh, wait, like, I'm unwelcome here, my friends are unwelcome here, I'm being, you know, my story is being told for the entertainment value of someone else rather than for me.
Or at least with me in mind, my sensibilities in mind. It doesn't, like, you know what, I've never been against straight people writing male-male fiction and being a part of, like, 100% welcome. Several of my co-authors are straight and I love working with them and I'm really happy. And you know what, it's okay for them to write for themselves and to write for straight people, but at least write adjacent to my needs. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't write in opposition of me. If you can just not write in opposition of queer people, I think that is actually completely acceptable. You don't have to get rid of all your fluffy tropes. You don't have to stop writing white cock. You can really, like, by all means, enjoy all the white cock you want. It
Gorge
is
yourself.
Totally cool. Yes. But yeah, that's my thing is, yeah, like, just don't write something that's actively hostile to queer people. It doesn't have to be, doesn't have to center us, like, completely. I'm giving ground here because, you know, there are some people who say, no, your queer fiction should center queer people. I'm saying at least don't hurt us.
Yeah.
At the least.
Yeah, don't punch down.
Yeah, and, you know, and if you're going to write male-male that, you know, doesn't have surprise vaginas and bisexual people don't exist and yada, 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 then call it male-male. There's so many authors who very much write male-male romance who call themselves LGBT authors. And it's just like, if you are calling yourself an LGBT author or an LGBT reader, but you're complaining that there's a trans character or you're complaining that a bisexual person acts bisexual in whatever context, then don't use that word. Just say MM. That's fine. Like, it's an umbrella term.
Stay in your lane.
Yeah, it's an umbrella term, and it's useful as an umbrella term. But don't use it when you're actively against the umbrella. Like, male-male falls under the umbrella of LGBT, but if you are literally hostile to transgender people, take that fucking T off there. Like, take it right off.
Yeah. Well, on that angry note...
We're just really pleasant people. We're just kind, very quiet.
Just reorder the interview so that, like, the positive stuff.
Start with screaming, end with warm and fuzzy feelings. Well,
thank you again to Heidi for joining us. And if you want to continue the conversation on Twitter, I am at Amanda H. Jean.
I am at Austin Chanted.
And I am at Heidi Bellow. And Bellow is spelled B-E-L-L-E-A-U.
All right.
Can I say thank you for having me?
Thank you for having Heidi.
Fucking Christ.
Thank us for having Heidi. Thank you for joining
us,
Heidi.
Us.
Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Dario DeFore, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at VHR Podcast, add us on Facebook, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.